November 1973, Pioneer 10 took off on a journey to the stars. It carries with it a message from the people of Earth. On board is a plaque that tells who we are and where we live, our calling card to the stars. Pioneer will eventually leave our solar system. No one knows if its message will ever be received. There may be many civilizations among the stars, and making contact with them is one of man's most exciting adventures. But has that contact already been made? Is it possible that astronauts from other worlds have already visited us and left behind their calling cards here on Earth? One startling hypothesis about man's past begins with an alien spacecraft approaching Earth. Man was still primitive and uncivilized. In terror and wonder, he watched the descent of the fiery gods from heaven. The spacecraft landed and the astronauts walked on Earth. They performed great deeds and departed. And to this day, the tale of their coming is related in ancient legends found throughout the globe. 9 years ago, this remarkable thesis created a sensational worldwide bestseller. It drew a completely new picture of man's prehistory. The book was Chariots of the Gods, written by the Swiss author Erich von Däniken.
I try to prove that this planet has been visited by beings from outer space several times in antiquity. Second, I say that one of these first visits was the reason why Homo sapiens has become intelligent. So they made with our forefathers a kind of artificial mutation. And finally, these visits from outer space have gone into old religions, into mythology, and even at some cases into archaeological artifacts.
Could these strange lines on the Peruvian desert be the landing strips of space vehicles? Did the natives there carve pictures of their visitors from the stars? Could these prehistoric cave paintings be portraits of ancient astronauts? Do these statues depict space suits? And does this carving from Mexico show a space traveler crouched in his rocket? Is this figure in a centuries-old Mayan text wearing modern space equipment? And are these old engravings from Peru yet more spacemen? How can one explain these carvings which show beings gazing through modern telescopes at the stars? Is this 16th century map so accurate that it could only have been copied from satellite photographs? And the massive structures of the ancient world, did astronauts help build the pyramids? The statues of Easter Island? And the huge, elaborate buildings in South America? And who gave this African tribe detailed knowledge of invisible stars only discovered last century? Astronauts from other worlds? These are the questions von Däniken answers in startling fashion. And if he's right, we can tear up the history books.
Das gibt nur wieder Mist. Es gibt nichts Ernstes.
He has sold over 40 million copies of his books worldwide, and his popularity shows no sign of diminishing. His appeal may lie partly in his continual, almost contemptuous challenging of orthodox views. And although his theories may be scorned by traditional scientists, they've certainly struck home with the public. Most of the year, he spends traveling.
30,000 different ideas. I don't believe it. Look at this damn thing. Colima. How far is it from the ocean?
Everywhere he seeks new evidence for the visits of ancient astronauts. People are intrigued by his findings. Many suspect that perhaps the conventional view of our past is wrong, because von Daniken produces evidence to prove it.
Die gezielte künstliche Mutation erfolgte nach ihrem Ebenbilde.
Why are his ideas so popular? One person who studied the Daniken phenomenon, himself an expert on extraterrestrial intelligence, is Professor Carl Sagan.
We are thinking beings. We are interested and excited in understanding how the world is put together. We seek out the extraordinary. And if you think of these claims, if only they were true, they would be amazingly interesting that we have been visited by beings from elsewhere who not only have created our civilization for us, but mated with human beings. It's, in my view, much more likely to successfully mate with a petunia than an extraterrestrial. But certainly there is a degree of fascination if such accounts were true.
Von Daniken himself is unmoved by such skepticism.
I accept and admit that this theory will not convince conservative scientists, but this has always been like this. There is not one simple theory which today is the truth, which has convinced in those days the scientists. Take, for example, when the first cave paintings were discovered in Spain, in the Altamira caves or other places, the whole archaeological world were against it. They all said, it must be a fake, it's wrong. Well, it's not. It takes usually a generation, or at least 10 or 20 years, until a new theory will be accepted. And I have learned during this past 15 years that I should not try to convince scientists who are strictly against it, because they have another opinion. I should try to bypass them, overpass them, to come out with better answers and more reasonable solutions. So don't lose your time in convincing them. Just come out with better material.
Von Daniken's theory is remarkable, yet by no means totally impossible. So how good is his evidence? Buried deep in the remote Mexican jungle lie the ruined temples and palaces of a vanished civilization, that of the Maya. Here at Palenque, in the 7th century AD, the Indians of the sophisticated Mayan culture built a great ceremonial center. When the Maya passed on, the great temples lay hidden for over 1,000 years. They were excavated only 60 years ago. Beneath this temple was found one of von Daniken's major pieces of evidence. It is a huge sarcophagus lid in an underground burial chamber. Elaborately carved, it depicts what? Von Daniken interprets it in this way.
There sits a human being, with the upper part of his body bent forward like a racing motorcyclist. Today, any child would identify his vehicle as a rocket. It is pointed at the front, then changes to strangely grooved indentations like inlet ports, widens out, and terminates at the tail in a darting flame. The crouching being himself is manipulating a number of undefinable controls and has the heel of his left foot on a kind of pedal. His clothing is appropriate. Short trousers with a broad belt, a jacket with a modern Japanese opening at the neck, and closely fitting bands at arms and legs. With our knowledge of similar pictures, we should be surprised if the complicated headgear were missing. And there it is, with the usual indentations and tubes, and something like antennae on top. Our space traveler, he is clearly depicted as one, is not only bent forward tensely, He is also looking intently at an apparatus hanging in front of his face.
Could this startling interpretation that the slab depicts an astronaut be a valid one? To check such claims, the object must be seen against its historical and archaeological background. In this case, as part of the art and architecture of the Mayan civilization, which has been intensively studied for half a century. Dr. Ian Graham is an expert on Mayan symbols. He came to Palenque to give us his interpretation of the carving on the slab. The sighting of the tomb is unusual. No other Mayan temple has a staircase like this one leading into the heart of the building. It took 4 years hard digging to excavate this stairway. No one knew or expected what lay below. A second stairway was found, descending this time below ground level. At the bottom, a stone slab concealed the doorway to an impressive tomb. Inside was the Palenque sarcophagus. Nothing as elaborate as this had ever been found before. The tomb slab was raised. Below it was a sealed coffin. When this was opened, it revealed the skeleton of a man, richly adorned with jade ornaments. Hieroglyphics on the tomb identified him as Pakal, a 7th century ruler. And this is his funeral monument. Ian Graham.
Well, I certainly don't see any need to regard him as a spaceman. I don't see any oxygen tubes. I see a very characteristically drawn Maya face with the sloping forehead, which is rather common among the Maya, although sometimes it's been exaggerated by deformation during early childhood. And this is crowned by an elaborate hairdo and elements of headdress. Here, an earring suspended from a pierced ear, a nose plug, which has the elements of death because it takes the form of a fleshless bone. Here on his chest, he has a jeweled pectoral ornament suspended by a chain, the end of it which flares out, or rather a beaded cord. On his wrists, there is a very typical bracelet. Around his waist, a beaded belt with a death head in front, and a beaded skirt, which is not at all unusual, and anklets, likewise.
And the hand on the rocket's controls?
As a matter of fact, it's fairly plain that this hand isn't holding on to anything. The Maya like to show hands in rather delicate gestures, many of which may have had meanings which so far escape us. I think this is just a delicate position of the hand.
Such gestures are common in Mayan art. There are similar examples on the side of the slab. But what about the rocket flames at the base?
These famous flames from the rocket have quite a different explanation. Because we see, for instance, this element around here as consisting of two serpent heads uniting in the bottom.
In Ian Graham's view, the base developed from a serpent's head, which the Maya made more and more stylized. Eventually, the serpent's jaws became rigid shapes with a stylized beard below the lower jaw. The jaws are opened, and when this shape is paired with its mirror image, it develops into the shape around the base of the slab. Two serpents joined at the middle, whose beards form von Daniken's rocket flames. On this drawing of the Palenque slab is another two-headed serpent interpreted as a Mayan symbol of kingship. It has an eye, a lower jaw with teeth and a beard, and a gaping upper jaw. The elaborate design can now be broken down by removing first the double-headed serpent on top, the symbol of kingship. Next, the dead ruler himself. and finally the lower two-headed serpent that forms the base. This leaves on top a bird symbolizing heaven, a cross-shaped device, the Mayan saber tree supporting heaven, and below a grotesque earth monster, symbol of the underworld. The important point is that these same symbols can be found elsewhere in Mayan art. For example, the earth monster, the cross, and the bird are all found on this carving from another temple. Does this resemble a rocket? This is from the Temple of the Cross at Palenque. There are many other examples. The symbols here are common throughout the Maya world. They've been studied for 50 years and they tell a consistent story. The Quetzal bird, a Mayan symbol for heaven, is again found on the Palenque slab. Here it's perched on the nose cone of the supposed rocket and would presumably have had an uncomfortable time at takeoff.
I am absolutely familiar myself with the archaeological explanation, but I do not agree. I know for sure we have, in the case of the Palenque slab, a lot of designs, carvings, or what archaeologists call glyphics, which we know from other Maya places. But the question I have is, have they been interpreted from the very beginning correctly? You know, archaeology, in my opinion, is one of the very conservative sciences. And I do not doubt, not at all, the integrity or the honesty of any archaeologist. But I ask myself, do they interpret their findings correct? To me, the Palenque stone still today looks like a modern man sitting in some kind of technical apparatus. We have never found in the whole Maya literature a man sitting in the same position. That's for the first and the only time. So I hope we should wait until we find another guy like this.
Certainly the figure is in an unusual posture for Maya art, but it seems to me to be quite a logical way to show a figure who is in a cosmological setting between the earth, as represented by this earth monster, and the sky, supported by the great saber tree that we've seen. And I see no need at all to invoke any really extreme and extravagant interpretation involving astronauts when the so much simpler and more consistent explanation presents itself of a mere mortuary slab showing the deceased in his passage towards heaven, the Maya heaven.
So looked at in context, are these figures from a Mayan text more likely to be spacemen, as von Daniken suggests, or Mayan gods engaged in the elaborate rites of a richly symbolic culture? Is this prehistoric carved figure wearing a space helmet, or is it more likely to be braided hair? Is this a Chinese spacesuit or a ceremonial suit of armor? And are these Benin bronze figures wearing space apparatus or necklaces? Von Daniken claims these cave paintings from Tassili resemble spacemen. But could they not have developed from masked figures like this Tassili archer? Couldn't this simply be a painting of a ritual costume? This figure gives von Daniken the impression that it's dressed in a spacesuit, and it does indeed resemble a famous space-age image of today. But it also resembles the many masks still worn in African tribal ceremonies today. These theories rely on the odd assumption that beings from other worlds looked remarkably like modern man and dressed in 20th century spacesuits. Using this logic, what could future archaeologists make of this? A three-stage rocket complete with launch vehicle, command module, and a lunar lander on top. They might well wonder how the Irish in the 18th century could have known of such a vehicle and why they placed it in Dublin. Another startlingly modern interpretation is given to the mysterious lines on the Nazca Desert in Peru. Von Daniken writes,
you can make out gigantic lines laid out geometrically, some of which run parallel to each other while others intersect. The archaeologists call them Inca roads, a preposterous idea. Seen from the air, the clear-cut impression they made on me was that of an airfield.
In fact, no modern archaeologist claims the lines are roads. The only real road on the desert is the Pan-American Highway. And as the lines often run for miles, cross hills and go over the edges of cliffs, it's a strange pattern for a spaceport.
You effortlessly cross hundreds of light years of interstellar space. The space vehicle sets down on the ground. The great bay opens. And out wheel what? B-24 Liberators? Spitfires? Most remarkable that they need airfields. And that is a kind of temporal chauvinism, which the whole subject is immersed in, unfortunately.
In fact, if anything heavy leaves one of the modern paths crossing the plain and drives onto a Nazca line, it simply gets stuck.
I never said that the extraterrestrial needed runways with concrete or something like this. My idea, which I developed in my second book and also in the book In Search of Ancient Gods, the picture book, was that some vehicle was coming down, not an interstellar spaceship, simply a small vehicle, and landing with an effect maybe even of the air cushion system. So they don't need landing tracks, but simply by the landing itself, some sand and stones are blown away and you have a simple track on the ground. And after maybe a few hours or a few days, they start again, maybe in another direction, you have a second track, the take-off track. I assumed that only later, when the extraterrestrials departed, the natives came to the ground and saw these two lines, landing track and take-off track, and they would whisper, the fiery gods rode on these lines. And only now they start to protect the lines, to construct the lines, and maybe in the later generations, to make new lines to the east and west and north and south, some direction to stars, because they feel or they saw that the gods have come from the stars. So the interpretation of mine is not lines with concrete, as on a two-day airfield, but it was a landing, yes, I still suggest this.
But there is another explanation of the lines. It comes from someone who has spent a lifetime studying them. The German scientist, Maria Reicher. For over 35 years, working virtually alone and unaided, Maria Reicher has walked almost every foot of the Nazca Desert, measuring and calibrating the shapes in the sand. The Nazca Desert is covered with small rocks that have oxidized to a purplish-brown color. The sand underneath is yellow, and it's this contrast in color that was used by the Nazca people 1,000 years ago to make the lines.
They pushed away the dark stones from the surface to the borders where you can see an accumulation of larger stones, and left a surface which in former times was much lighter than now. The wind has carried from the surrounding surface very small dark pebbles over the lines, and if we sweep away these dark pebbles, then we restore a line to its original very white light color. You can see the lines are absolutely straight, and people have wondered very often how the ancient people could do these straight lines without any engineering instruments. I had an interesting experience which gave me the clue to this. I had a helper who had been a furrow tracer, which means a man who prepares the fields for future irrigation and traces absolutely straight, very, very long furrows. This fellow had such good eyesight that he could put a stake at a very, very large distance and scrape along with his foot an absolutely straight furrow. He could see everything that I saw through the telescope of the theodolite, he could see with the naked eyes.
Maria Riker has shown that many of these long, straight lines are connected with the calendar. Some of them, for example, pointed to the place where the sun set at the summer or winter solstice, the time when the seasons change. The Earth's axis has shifted since the lines were drawn, so in this photograph, taken at the winter solstice, the sun has moved from its original position. There are many such lines, and they've led to the interpretation of the Nazca plane as a gigantic astronomical calendar. One clue comes from the animal figures drawn on the plane. These figures may be connected with the seasons. Many of them, like this giant bird, are also found on the pottery of the Nazca people. There's a huge fish stranded in the desert. A giant spider some 100 meters across. And a monkey, which according to Maria Riker is the symbol for the coming of rain. This is confirmed by a calendar drawn on a Nazca pot symbolizing the Nazca year, which in ancient times began in June with the arrival of the sun. As the sun gets hotter, drought begins and the dogs starve. The year goes on. The continuing drought is symbolized by cats eating human beings. The drought grows fiercer. Even birds begin to attack people. Then things suddenly change. The monkey arrives, and with him comes the rain. The year has reached a turning point. The water fills the river, and fish and shrimp appear. The animals grow fat and begin to produce young. And finally comes the harvest, symbolized by the god of maize. So the Nazcan year revolved around the arrival of the monkey. Why this symbol for the coming of rain? The answer is in the stars. In the southern hemisphere, the constellation of the lion, the hunting dogs, and the plough resemble a monkey, with its tail to the left and head to the right. The Nazca people drew this monkey on the ground. The monkey is connected by a thin line to a broad Nazca line that points directly to the rising of the plough on December the 21st, the time when the rains began.
The most important problem of the people who live in this region and still now is the arrival of the water in the rivers. They have been dry all through the year, and agriculture begins with the arrival of the water. This they had to prepare their fields for this and had to know when the water was to be expected. To make it bring more water, they would put its image on such a large size on the ground that this divinity could see its own picture from above and would be favorably inclined to send more water.
Similar signs to gods are found around the world, but is that a reason to suggest these gods were astronauts? Seen from the air, Christian churches are shaped like a cross. The symbolism is akin to that at Nazca. A curious piece of evidence appears in von Daniken's book, a photograph of the Nazca plane with the legend, "This is very reminiscent of the aircraft parking bays on a modern airport." We filmed the same area. It may look like a parking place, but that's not what it is. The photograph is deceptive. The whole area is only some 20 feet across. In fact, it's part of a giant bird, only visible from the air. The parking place turns out to be part of the left leg of a huge condor.
That's absolutely true. You are right here. This photograph, which is in the original version of Chariots of the Gods, is not my photograph. And even the legend, you know, the writing under the photograph was not made by me. It was too late later to correct it. Anyhow, I fully admit that this explanation of being a parking place is simply ridiculous.
Ridiculous it may be, but after 9 years it remains uncorrected in von Daniken's book. Many readers are being misled. So, does one accept von Daniken's interpretations, or those of someone like Maria Riker, who has studied the lines for years?
The things on the Pampa have harmony and beauty in them. They are exceptionally artistical. They have been made by people that were kind of primitive intellectuals, we could say. And that is a riddle that has kept me until now. Once everything would be solved, I would lose interest. My book will never finish, because so much is immense.
Most of the stories of ancient astronauts use the ploy of choosing remote cultures. So von Daniken has plenty of questions about the statues of Easter Island.
Who cut the statues out of the rock? Who carved them? How were they dressed, polished, and erected? How were they moved across country for miles without rollers? And how do they manage it?
The implication is that ancient astronauts were involved. In 1955, an expedition landed at Easter Island, led by the Norwegian explorer Thor Heyerdahl. He asked the natives how the statues had been erected and published his results in a book, Aku Aku, which came out 10 years before Chariots of the Gods. Were the statues still an unsolved puzzle?
No, it is not a mystery any longer today. We actually, we know who made them, when they made them, why they made them, how they made them, and even when they stopped making them. As a matter of fact, they were made by the ancestors of the people living on the island today. And through tradition, they remember how their ancestors did it, and they did it in front of our eyes, erected and carved a statue. It looked like a very slow procedure in the beginning, but they poured on water as they worked. And when they first got inside the hard outer shelf of the rock, the work went much quicker.
They used no advanced technology, only crude stone picks, thousands of which were found in the old quarries.
Does this look to you like a very sophisticated tool, or the tool from a spacecraft? This is a typical Paleolithic tool, a Stone Age tool. It's not even polished as some of the other tools they used. This is what they used for carving the statues.
After only a few days, the outline of a statue had already appeared.
We went on only for 3 days to make an estimate, and it was easy for the archaeologists to figure out that even the largest statues could be completed within a year.
Von Daniken claims the island was too barren to provide rope or wood for levers. But Heyerdahl found plenty of evidence for both, and he actually filmed men making rope from the local tough reeds. He also persuaded the islanders to show him how their ancestors had moved the statues.
Since we, with less than 200 men, could transport an average statue, even if they didn't concentrate on one statue at a time, they could easily transport two or three or four statues with a couple of thousand men. The island could, with no difficulty whatsoever, feed 10,000, 20,000 people. Scientists have been estimating really what the agriculture could feed there, and with no problem 20,000 people.
The island's forests have been destroyed by fire and agriculture, but at the time of the statues there was plenty of wood for levers. Under the direction of the mayor, the islanders used these to raise a statue as their ancestors had done. They levered up each side and placed rocks underneath. Very soon, the statue lay on a platform of boulders. more rocks were placed underneath to support the statue as the levers gradually inched it upright. It took 12 men, 3 levers, and 18 days to erect the statue. What was needed was not space technology, but human effort and ingenuity, and lots of time.
This is a matter of not hundreds of years, but more than 1,000 years that these statues were carved. So by carving a few at a time, there is no problem at all to explain why close to 1,000 statues came about.
On Easter Island, as elsewhere, von Daniken underestimates the ability of people who, to his eyes, are primitive and unsophisticated.
Well, I think that the people we met there, they proved they were intelligent enough to do it because they did it. And I think it is a pity that we underestimate other people because they don't have the technical standing knowledge we have today. Anybody who has lived among the so-called primitive people will know that their intelligence is exactly like our own, and their ability to solve problems, I must confess, is usually superior to that of modern man today.
The Easter Island statues were made by men. To invoke the aid of space gods involves deliberately ignoring the evidence. The more remote the location, the easier it is to ignore or distort the facts, as here in the Andean mountains of Peru. The Inca Empire dominated this area between the 12th and 16th centuries. In these mountains, von Daniken finds more of his strange evidence. He asks how ordinary mortals could have carved these elaborately shaped rocks. Are they thrones for giants? In fact, it's an Inca quarry, later turned into a shrine. Von Daniken hints that this rock may have been seared by immense heat, lasers perhaps. In fact, it's been scoured by glaciers. Nearby is the Inca fortress of Sacsahuaman. He asks, how could primitive people handle such huge blocks? What strange forces were at work here? The descendants of the Incas still survive. To Western eyes, they only appear primitive because they're remote and poor. But it was their ancestors that created the Inca Empire, one as powerful as that of Napoleon or Alexander the Great. For 10 years, Dr. Anne Kendall has worked among these people. She's a British archaeologist who was about to embark on a major 5-year excavation of a new Inca site. She's an expert on Inca building techniques and knows Sacsahuaman well. At the fortress, most of the largest stones were quarried locally, so they didn't have to be dragged a great distance. And there is a logical pattern to the way the Incas built with these stones.
First, the biggest stone is placed. Then, a series of other stones, as you can see here, have been placed in series in a sort of stepped fashion, like this. And then perhaps, at a certain point, another enormous stone is placed, and it's not very carefully shaped. The other stones have been selected and shaped to fit it, because it's always easier to fit the smaller stones to the bigger stone.
According to the Spanish chronicles of the time, the stones were raised by ramps and levers, and the sockets where these levers were inserted are still plainly visible. But how was the tight fit achieved?
The Spanish chroniclers always marvelled that they could not insert the points of their knives between these stones. Well, you can see it's an extremely tight fit, of course, and this would have been achieved when the stones were being fitted together, because the stone would have been chopped away on each side. It would have been struck with hammers, round river stone type hammers, in order to get to chop this back for this tight fit. And then, as you see here, the stones haven't been fitted at all. They've been left quite large gaps between them. I mean, who's going to bother, quite honestly, to make these stones fit? Imagine the extra amount of work if every single stone had to fit absolutely perfect inside the wall, where it was never going to be seen again.
So the close-fitting stones show a human logic and expertise at work. Along the walls, you can see how the Incas gradually reduced the size of the blocks towards the top, and how they're built in a step fashion to give added strength. It's the work of masters of stone, not masters of space travel. This eminently practical building method sprang from many centuries of working in stone. The Inca terraces that enabled them to farm on the steep sides of mountains are all held up by closely fitting stone walls. In Peruvian quarries today, stone is still worked in much the same way as it was at the time of the Incas. Metal chisels split the rock along a naturally straight surface. The Incas obtained similar results. They then used round river boulders to finish the surface. This produced the mottled effect that can still be seen in the stonework of old Inca walls. The builders here were not unskilled peasants. Their work is undoubtedly impressive, but it should be compared with the castles and cathedrals being built in Europe at the same time. No one suggests, of course, that they were the work of astronauts.
Well, it's absolutely nonsense to think of the Incas and primitive people in this. I mean, just not, don't go in the same context, do they? The Incas were able to conquer the Andean area from one end to the other, to unify three very different geographic zones, jungle, mountains, and desert coasts. They were able to organize 20,000 people per annum to work on Sacsayhuaman alone, and goodness knows they had enough large building projects elsewhere as well. So when one thinks of a people with that sort of organizational ability, let alone the sort of technical abilities which they had and were, we've seen here at Sacsayhuaman in the fortress, I don't think the question even arises.
The most impressive monuments of the ancient world are the pyramids at Giza. They've long been a source of mystery. Von Daniken suggests the Great Pyramid at Giza contains hidden formulae for finding the height of the sun and the secrets of immortality. He writes,
"The Great Pyramid is and remains visible testimony of a technique that has never been understood. Today, in the 20th century, no architect could build a copy of the Pyramid of Cheops, even if the technical resources of every continent were at his disposal. We know next to nothing of the how, why, and when of the building of the pyramid. An artificial mountain, 490 feet high, weighing 31 million tons, stands there as evidence of a remarkable achievement. "2,600,000 gigantic blocks were cut out of the quarries, dressed and transported and fitted together to the nearest thousandth of an inch. The pyramid, like so many other wonderful things, shot out of the ground, so to speak."
course, it helps the astronaut theory if things appear suddenly. In fact, the Great Pyramid is the culmination of a long tradition. 200 years before it, on the edge of the desert west of the Nile, the first tombs of the pharaohs were being built. They were underground chambers called mastabas, built of sun-dried mud bricks. From these simple tombs developed the true pyramids. The first was at Saqqara, the stepped pyramid of King Zoser. Zoser's pyramid began as an ordinary mastaba, with tomb chambers and passages underneath. A small stepped pyramid was later built on top, and then a second, larger pyramid was added, leaving the structure that we see today. This was to be the model for all later pyramids. The design of Zoser's pyramid owes its strength to the buttress walls that lean inwards to the center. But the next pyramid built was not so successful. At Meidum, a second large pyramid rose from the desert. What we see today is a ruin. Only the central core still stands. The Meidum structure was once covered by a stepped pyramid, and this in turn was filled in to give the true pyramid shape. One theory is that these outer casings collapsed suddenly, leaving the massive pile of rubble still seen surrounding the central core. From this disaster, the Egyptian architects learnt valuable lessons in building techniques. The next pyramid had its upper half made less steep, giving it a bent shape, and a subsequent pyramid was built entirely at this less steep angle. So by the time the Giza group was built, the Egyptians had learnt from 200 years of tradition and human error. Yet, according to von Daniken, there are still some things that require a highly advanced technology. He asks,
with what power, with what machines, with what technical resources was the rocky terrain levelled at all?
The architects had indeed levelled the base with remarkable accuracy, but there's a simple way of doing this. The area would be flooded with water to a depth of a foot or so. Holes would then be drilled to a fixed depth below the water surface, which was, of course, perfectly level. The water would be drained and the rock cut away to the level of the drill holes, leaving a flat and level surface. Another problem is how the pyramid sides were so accurately aligned to the points of the compass. They deviate only a fraction from the main east-west and north-south axes. But you don't need ancient astronauts to explain this accuracy. The fact that stars rose in the east and set in the west was well known to the Egyptian priests. Choosing a bright star, they could have marked its position as it rose, perhaps using an artificial horizon. They would then follow its path across the heavens until it set in the west. This position would also be marked. By bisecting the angle, true north is discovered, and one edge of the pyramid could be set against such a line. Nor is it technically difficult to get a straight edge.
Shemad, you mean?
A number of men with poles can do it by line of sight alone.
Tamam.
With more men and poles, the edge of the pyramid could be accurately plotted. The length of each side could be measured by laying sticks end to end. An experiment in the 20s showed this was accurate to a quarter of an inch over 100 yards. The Egyptian surveyors' mathematics were certainly good enough to measure accurately. But did they have more advanced knowledge? Von Daniken claims the pyramid's height multiplied by 1,000,000,000 gives the distance to the sun. This simply isn't so. The pyramid is 480.93 feet high. Multiply by 1,000,000,000 and you get just over 91 million miles. The sun's distance on average is 93 million miles, not the accuracy you'd expect from a space-traveling civilization. The numbers game can be played with anything. Multiply the Washington Monument's height by 40, and you get the distance in light-years to Proxima Centauri, our second nearest star. The ratio of the pyramid's height to its sides includes the figure pi, supposedly not discovered until the Greeks. But this could happen by chance. The Egyptians measured in units of 4 up to 1 along. If, for example, the unit of length is taken as one revolution of a wheel, the distance travelled is given by the formula for the circumference of a circle, pi times the diameter. So half one side is pi times the diameter, and the full side is twice this. The ratio of the height, 4 diameters of the wheel, to all the sides is 4d to 8 pi d, or 1 to 2 pi. So the magic figure appears without the Egyptians knowing it.
You say that there is a clear explanation how the Great Pyramid was constructed. And I know this explanation from archaeologists, and I still doubt it. By the way, I have not said in my book that the pyramid was constructed by extraterrestrials. I have speculated that extraterrestrials have left knowledge and tools to our forefathers so that it was easier for them to do it.
But we know what sort of tools they used. These simple copper chisels, now on display in the Cairo Museum, hardly the advanced technology of spacemen. Here, too, is the rope that von Daniken says was non-existent. Quantities have been found buried near the pyramid. There are examples of the non-existent wooden mallets and the non-existent rollers. We know what the tools are for and where they were used. These are the ancient stone quarries at Tura, 15 miles across the Nile from the pyramids. They provided many of the blocks for the Great Pyramid of Cheops. Marks of the chisels can still be seen on the rock face. The quarrymen would carve a slot into the face and then split out the blocks from behind. In some places, you can still find uncompleted blocks the size of those at Cheops. Despite this, von Daniken still believes that the building of Cheops presented insuperable problems to mere mortals.
Archaeology accepts that the Great Pyramid is constructed of about 2.5 millions of stone blocks, and they say it was constructed within 20 years. If you divide 2.5 millions of stone block within 20 years, it would make that every year they had to cut, to polish, to put on place, to transport 120,000 stone blocks. If you take an year with 300 working days, which is a good year because they had some festivities too, and you take a working day of 12 hours, then they had, in fact, to make this whole thing every 2 minutes one block. Repeat it today with our technology. How?
Yet even today, using very simple tools and methods, one or two men can easily break out a stone the size of those used in the pyramids. When we asked them to do it, it took about 15 minutes. The rock splits easily and usually along straight lines. The Egyptians would have used wooden wedges, but the principle is the same. In ancient Egypt, 10 men could easily have broken out about a dozen such stones in a week and been able to maneuver them without any great difficulty from the quarry. With 100,000 men, that would produce 120,000 stones in a season's quarrying, the figure needed to keep the pyramid building on schedule. The stone blocks then had to be moved from the quarries across the River Nile and up to the site of the pyramids. We know from wall paintings that then, as now, the Egyptians used large boats to transport the stones. For each team to transport its quota of 12 blocks to the Nile and then across would have taken about a month, all told. To carry the stones overland, they used wooden sleds like this one in the Cairo Museum. Wall paintings show teams of men hauling heavy loads like this statue on similar sleds. One man pours on water or oil to minimize the friction. To raise the stones, one theory shown in this model suggests they used a series of ramps going all round the pyramid. The teams of a dozen or so workmen would be responsible for hauling their own quarried stones to the top. 120,000 stones can be raised by 100,000 men in a year, given a good enough organization, something von Daniken ignores. Another theory suggests a single ramp increasing in size as the pyramid grows. Remains of such ramps have been found at Giza. A third theory follows the statement of Herodotus that the Egyptians used a machine. One of the commonest machines in rural Egypt today is the shadouf, used for raising water for irrigation. A simple modification of this could give a device for raising the blocks, and certainly the Egyptians would have understood the principle. The smooth finish of the blocks was achieved by equally simple methods. Wall paintings show masons using a device called a boning rod, in which a cord is stretched between two rods resting on the stone. A third rod of equal size is run along to pick up any irregularities. The smooth finish is due not to any superhuman skills, but to care and ingenuity. Von Daniken also suggests that the pyramids contain the secrets of immortality. The great pharaohs of Egypt, he suggests, received from the space gods knowledge that would one day enable them to return to life. Mummification held the secret, a technique given to the pharaohs by ancient astronauts and developed perhaps from the hibernation techniques they must have used on interstellar voyages.
So it seems to me quite reasonable if, for example, somebody from outer space would have told to a pharaoh, listen, we came back, let's say, in 5,000 years. We are able to reconstruct your body if you only take care that we find at least a few living cells of your body. But be careful, take your brain away into a separate pot, because if we want to construct also the same memory as you had, we need your brain separately.
Yet mummification is a bizarre way for an advanced race to preserve living beings. The brain was torn out through the nose by tweezers. The skull was often filled with resin. All the internal organs were removed. One could hold out little hope of even the most advanced astronauts succeeding in putting these bodies back together again.
You think we will find a perfectly preserved brain from that old?
No, I don't think a perfectly preserved brain, but maybe the liquid of the brain, or what is rest of it, or something like this. And I hope some living cells.
Speculation is one thing, but facts are another. And in Egypt, von Daniken gets most of his facts wrong. He's wrong, too, about the Piraeus map. His statements that the map is absolutely accurate and that Antarctica is precisely delineated aren't just matters of interpretation. They are strictly false. The map is very inaccurate. This iron pillar near Delhi is not 4,000 years old, nor is it made of unknown alloys. It's simply very pure iron that doesn't rust. Von Daniken now admits this was a mistake. The treasures of Father Crespi, supposedly from a lost civilization in Ecuador, do not prove the visits of spacemen. Von Daniken suggests, for example, that this one shows the number of astronauts buried in a pyramid. But these artifacts are mostly tourist souvenirs. There is no evidence for von Daniken's claim that they're ancient. From Gold of the Gods comes another impressive-sounding claim. Von Daniken writes,
To me, this is the most incredible, fantastic story of the century. It could easily have come straight from the realm of science fiction if I had not seen and photographed the incredible truth in person.
He describes visiting man-made tunnels in Ecuador containing fabulous gold and plastic artifacts from a lost civilization. In 1976, a British scientific expedition to the area explored the caves mentioned in von Daniken's book. The caves they found were completely natural formations and not man-made at all. They found none of von Daniken's fabulous artifacts, only the crudest carved figures. Although these caves are identical to those described in von Daniken's book, he claims the expedition went to the wrong place. Yet his own story is very confused. He says he visited the caves with the Ecuadorian explorer Juan Moritz. Moritz has since emphatically denied that von Daniken entered the caves or saw the treasures he describes. So did he visit the cave shown in the book or not?
The cave which we see in here, the photograph in my book, is a place where I have never been. I was not here. I said in the end of this book that this photograph was made by Juan Moritz. And this is a photograph which was made at the expedition of Juan Moritz in 1969. I was never here. I was on a side entrance on a complete different place.
But that's not what the book says. Von Daniken clearly describes descending by ropes and switching on his light to visit the underworld of a strange unknown race, illustrated by this very photograph.
When you described standing there dumbfounded as he switched on his light in a big hall, did that actually happen?
No, that did not happen. But I think when somebody writes books in my style and in my sense who are not scientific books, we call it in Germany Sachbücher. It's a kind of popular books, but it's not science fiction, because all the facts do exist, but with other interpretations. Then an author is allowed to use effects. So some little things like this are really not important because they do not touch the facts. They are simply stimulating the reader, and one is allowed to do this.
Yet these books are claimed to be factual. So how is the reader to know whether the author is using dramatic effects or whether he's simply telling lies? Another astonishing claim was made on the BBC's Tonight programme last year.
Now, part of your theory is that these beings from outer space endowed us with great knowledge many thousands of years ago, and part of that knowledge I believe you now have brand new proof for, in fact, that people were performing heart transplants years ago.
That's correct. Since so many years, near the city of Ica, which is in Peru, south of Lima, people, especially Indians, are collecting some stones of different sizes. And these stones have all engravings. They are collected today in a stone museum. Now you see some of these stones. They have engravings all around, completely. One example here, a kind of surgery is going on. Obviously,
that seems to be two surgeons bending over a body there.
That's correct. And the first surgeon, the one on the right side, has some instruments. And the one on the left side is going with his hands into the chest of the patient. And they take something out of the patient's heart, of the patient's chest. It's his heart, as you see here.
I don't see at all. How is that a heart?
It's a big heart. You see the arterias. It's anatomically perfect. So they took the heart out of the patient,
yes,
but they replace another heart. I took 126 photographs only concerning a heart transplantation. And as you see, they replanted and they closed the chest of the patient again with needle and thread.
That's the stitching we can see there, is it?
Yes.
Just the scar. And that's actually a needle. Yes, you can see the eye of the needle.
This is correct. It's absolutely strange. And we have 22,000 of these engraved stones today. That's quite a lot.
Von Daniken had visited Ica in Peru to examine the collection of carved stones himself. The museum is owned by a local surgeon, Dr. Cabrera, and Cabrera's collection contains some very strange things indeed. The stones show maps of the world, dinosaurs, medical operations, and men gazing through telescopes at the stars. Cabrera claims they're all many thousands of years old. While examining the Cabrera stones, von Däniken heard that similar ones were being made by local villagers a few miles away. He went to look. Out in the desert is a small village. There, a local artist called Basilio makes a living out of carving stones for sale to tourists. The stones did indeed resemble those in Dr. Cabrera's museum. Von Däniken inspected them closely.
Now, when you visited Ica and you saw first the stone collection in Dr. Cabrera's museum, and then went out to visit Brasilio, the gentleman making some of these stones, surely any reasonable man would realize that the two were one and the same.
No, they're not the same. Oh, not at all. I have a lot of photographs here, and naturally I had the stones to compare them. And what Basilio makes is absolutely different. We also made some microscopic photographs of the grooves, some of the Cabrera stones, which Cabrera claims are the real ones, and some of the Basilio stones, which we know were the wrong ones, and there is absolutely difference. Even in the motif, for example, in the Cabrera stones, which he claims to be the true ones, you find a lot of, say, unknown maps, sometimes detail maps and things like this. The motifs are different. You find a lot of animals, which are probably mythological animals. You find animals with the halos around their head and things like this. But the Basileus stones usually don't show such complicated motifs. They are very simple, like birds or fishes or what do I know, Indians and so on.
To check these claims, we went to Basileus' workshop. There were two questions. Were Basileus' stones physically different from the museum stones, and were they different in design? Basilio offered to carve us a heart transplant. He first drew the design, then began carving the soft rock with a knife. The characteristic face appeared within a few minutes. Then the internal organs of the heart transplant patient. And the typical cross-hatching found on all the Ica stones. After an hour, the design was finished. To get the antique look, Basilio uses the services of the local donkey. He bakes the stones in donkey dung for an hour and then covers them in boot polish. The final result, a transplant very like those in the museum. Basilio never claims his work is ancient. He admits his ideas come from magazines and children's books. Among these, he found one drawing that had inspired the transplant. Through our interpreter, we asked him had he done similar drawings for Dr. Cabrera. He said he'd done all of them. The drawing of the heart is indeed very similar to the supposedly ancient drawing in von Däniken's book. We showed Basilio von Däniken's latest book in which the Ica stones appear. Had he carved the stones shown in the photographs?
He says that he has done these stones, and it confirms this one with the face of this stone.
Basilio told us that these stones shown in von Däniken's book were among the first he'd made for Dr. Cabrera's museum, some 10 years ago.
We watched Basilio at work, and he made a heart transplant which was identical to those in the Cabrera Museum. And indeed, when we showed him the photographs in your book, he said that he had done those drawings and given them to Cabrera.
That's what he told me too. He told me he had done all the stones which Cabrera has, all of them. And naturally, I asked Cabrera if this is true, and he said, definitely no, the man is a liar.
We asked Basilio about this. He showed us a local paper with a photograph of Dr. Cabrera's museum. On it was a note thanking Basilio personally for his cooperation in providing stones for the museum. It was signed by Dr. Cabrera. We visited the Ica Museum in the hope of filming inside. Dr. Cabrera refused to allow us in, but he did hand over one stone from his collection, which he vouched for as being very old and genuine.
Thank you very much. And we will take this to Britain and get it analysed and let you have the results.
Dr. Cabrera insisted that he was a true South American scientist who possessed a deeper truth than scientists in Europe.
De hombre sigue el pensamiento tan avanzado como Europa, pero con una verdad más profunda que la que tienen todos ustedes en Europa.
The British scientists will study these stones in the real way.
Ojalá.
He hopes.
Pero no creo.
Was the carving of a dinosaur on this stone really many thousands of years old, as claimed? We asked the Institute of Geological Sciences in London to examine it. They looked first at the shape of the grooves. Under a microscope, the edges of the grooves were distinct and uneroded. Their conclusion? The sharp and relatively clean-cut edges of the grooves are notable, a feature which could not be preserved for long under normal weathering conditions. They then examined the brown layer on top of the stone where it had oxidized. If the carving were ancient, this oxidation should in time have covered the grooves, and it did not. They concluded, the grooves are seen to cut into this surface layer, indicating a carving which post-dated the development of the surface weathering. They also compared the Cabrera stone with one of Basilio's. The physical structure was the same. This is the structural makeup of the museum stone, and this is Basilio's stone. The elements are the same. The report ended, in conclusion, the similarity of the old and new pebbles, petrographically, in surface rock powder, and in sharpness of grooving, is evidence against any great antiquity of the carving on the old pebble. The Ica stones are modern. Von Daniken has been taken in by Cabrera's story, which, after all, suited his purposes. The evidence presented so forcibly turned out to be worthless. In his latest book, Beweiser, in English, According to the Evidence, von Daniken asks to be judged as if in a court of law on the evidence he presents. His handling of the Ica stones means the verdict must be guilty. In his books, he lays down a challenge to orthodoxy, to everything taught in schools and universities, but it is a false challenge. Von Daniken is part of a growing movement of irrationalism that more often than not attacks established knowledge with a great deal of verve but little solid evidence. It's too popular to be simply ignored or laughed at, and too important because any move away from real knowledge can be dangerous. Science fiction writer Isaac Asimov.
If we really develop a strong anti-science bias, if we really come to develop too strongly on irrationalisms, which have nothing to do with the universe as it is, if we turn away from science, we make it certain that civilization will collapse. It is for that reason that science and scientists must fight to establish the rational view, must fight to try to persuade people that it is dangerous to lean on irrationalisms, not because scientists want the prestige, not because scientists want power, rather because scientists, as I take it, would like to have the privilege of attempting to save civilization.
In a way, von Daniken himself is in the salvation business. His lectures have all the feel of a religious revival meeting. He's there to preach gods, and the fact that they're false gods doesn't affect his appeal. He is a prophet, but today he is no longer crying in the wilderness.
Ich behaupte, erstens, dieser Planet erhielt in frühgeschichtlichen und vorgeschichtlichen Zeiten mehrmals Besuch aus dem Weltall.
Why does this claim that ancient astronauts have visited Earth have such an impact? Carl Sagan.
The idea that we are being visited, or were once visited, by powerful, benign beings who live in the sky is, after all, a religious idea. The terminology is just slightly different. We don't talk about angels, we talk about extraterrestrials, but the emotional significance is identical. So at a time when, for whatever reason, religions have gradually declined in the degree to which the average person believes in them, but the same emotional needs are there, at a time when our society is in occasionally rather dire straits, it would be very nice to believe that there are powerful beings that look after us that are up there in the sky and may dip in and make things right. And goodness, I would be delighted if that happened. But you see, it's a dangerous doctrine if it's false, because it might, for example, lead us to do less than our own best effort to put things right.
There is, however, just one story where it is difficult to provide a rational solution. In a way, then, it's a test of how you regard such claims. The story concerns the star Sirius and its small companion star, Sirius B. In 1976, Dr. Irving Lindenblad took the first decent photographs of Sirius B, a star totally invisible to the naked eye and only discovered late last century. By the 1920s, Sirius B was recognized as a new type of star, a collapsed sun called a white dwarf. It was the first such star ever discovered. In this photo, the bright central star is Sirius, with refraction images on each side. On the bottom right is Sirius B. What is astonishing is that this recently discovered star has apparently been known about for centuries in Africa. For the Dogon tribe in Mali, the invisible Sirius B is the most important star in the heavens. Every 60 years, in the Sigwe ceremony, they celebrate its existence and its orbit through the heavens. Dogon traditions, which go back for centuries, involve many complex drawings in the sand, and one such drawing is of Sirius and its companion. This is how they depict the main star, Sirius. Close to it is the invisible Sirius B. Sirius B, say the Dogon, orbits the main star every 50 years. They draw a second position for B. There is a remarkable resemblance between the Dogon drawing and the real picture of the Sirius system, in which Sirius B does indeed go round Sirius every 50 years. This remarkable accuracy was the starting point for a recent book, The Sirius Mystery. Von Daniken called it a masterpiece. Its author is Robert Temple. An American living in England and a member of the Royal Astronomical Society, Temple has for 8 years been obsessed with the Dogon's knowledge. He became convinced that this knowledge could only have come from beings from Sirius itself. Why was he so impressed with the Dogon's knowledge of Sirius B?
The fact that they know it's there is extraordinary enough, but the fact that they know its exact orbital period is just totally incredible. But it doesn't stop there. They seem to realize that the star is super dense, as we know it is, because it's a white dwarf. And super dense matter really only makes sense if you have a theory of nuclear physics. Well, now the Dogon don't have a theory of nuclear physics. So clearly the information came from somewhere which was more advanced than their particular culture is technologically. Where did this information come from? How on earth did they get it? It's a mystery. That's why the book is called The Sirius Mystery.
Temple believes the Dogon's knowledge came not directly from Sirius, but via Egypt. The Egyptian god Isis represented Sirius, the brightest star in the heavens. Isis had a dark companion, Osiris. Temple sees this dark companion as a hidden reference to the companion star of Sirius, the invisible Sirius B. He traces it even further back to the legend of Oannes, a fish-tailed god who taught the Sumerians arts and sciences. The Dogon, too, have a fish-tailed god who is connected with the ceremonies of Sirius B, and who they describe as landing in a fiery arc like a rocket. The logical explanation is that the Dogon's knowledge comes not from ancient astronauts, but from visiting 20th century Westerners, missionaries or traders who knew about Sirius B. We put this to the eminent French anthropologist Madame Germaine Dietelin, who has lived for many years among the Dogon and who discovered they knew about not one but two invisible stars around Sirius.
I will explain you these two masks. They are probably originally Soninke, coming from the north, and then in use, but only very secretly, in secret societies on the Niger River. They are spirit signs, and the signs mean something. And this is a female and this is a male. And on the female, I can explain you, you have the three stars here, Sirius and the two companions. And at the top, you have the three same stars, Sirius and the two companions. There is everywhere. And you have the same representation on the male one, that is Sirius, one companion and the other.
In numerous Dogon masks, the head represents Sirius, the horns, two invisible companion stars. In this carving, these are the two companions, placed around the main star, Sirius. But how old is this tradition?
3,000 years before. So 1,000 years before Christ. And they have masks and they have ceremonies like that. Then on the river of Niger, where the masks on, this is the same story. This is a lot of population who has this tradition. And very normally, they think not, it is not extraordinary to have.
So the idea that it could have been told in the 20th century to them
is absurd. 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 It's impossible. They have it before. And the representation I show you are certainly of 13th or 14th century.
How do you think these people have such an exact knowledge of stars which to the naked eye are invisible?
I don't know. They have.
So the Dogon's knowledge, if it's being interpreted correctly, is certainly mysterious. But the myths and images of the Dogon Sirius ceremony are subtle and complex. There are problems if you take them too literally. For instance, their drawing of Sirius B's orbit is also described by them as an egg. The stars are inside this orbit, not on it, as you'd expect. They place a third star in the middle with the planet, but there are also many other symbols representing mythical beings and general concepts. In Temple's book, these last symbols are omitted, and the diagram turned round so it more closely resembles the true astronomical picture. So only the parts that fit the theory have been selected.
Well, I take it literally when they have specific quantities. When they give an orbital period, you have to take it literally because it's a number. But you have to deal with this highly symbolic, very rich tradition in the way that it requires. Our normal Western approach to these subjects is insufficient for an appreciation of the many dimensionalities of what they're trying to tell us.
One thing the Dogon do tell us is that there is a third star in the Sirius system. No such star has yet been found. If it is, the Dogon will have been proved right. Dr. Lindenblad has been looking for this star. In the 20s, wobbles in the orbit of Sirius B caused astronomers to think these might indeed be caused by a third star. Now, new measurements have been made.
They thought they had found a perturbation that would indicate a third star. Well, we were able to show by our work that that perturbation did not exist, and that apparently there is no third star close in, at least, to Sirius B or Sirius A.
But could it be further out? One way to find out is to check possible orbits. This is the orbit of Sirius, this of Sirius B, and this a hypothetical orbit for Sirius C. The Dogon say B and C come closest every 32 years. It is possible to make this happen. In this computer model, B and C at the top are at one of their closest points, and they meet again in 32 years on the right. But to do this, they must go in opposite directions. The Dogon, however, say they go the same way round. And when this happens, B and C move apart and cannot meet every 32 years. So the Dogon's knowledge here is inconsistent and conflicts with astronomical theory. It was intriguing enough, however, to try an experiment. Dr. Paul Feldman is engaged in a search for extraterrestrial radio signals at the Algonquin Radio Telescope in Canada. As part of this search, he agreed to try listening in to Sirius. They employed the standard procedures used in all such searches.
Neil, we'll be moving to Sirius now. I have the coordinates. They're 0644 05.2 minus 1642 39.
In principle, any normal radio noise, such as telecommunications or radar from an advanced civilization, should be picked up.
We'll start integrating on Sirius now.
They listen on specified frequencies for set periods of time.
We're underway.
They were looking for a sharp peak in the signal. The telescope listened for 3 10-minute periods, but with negative results.
Well, there certainly doesn't seem to be anything definite there. It would have been nice to find the signal, either natural or unnatural, but I'm afraid I can't say we have at this point. We would continue if we thought we stood much of a chance of any success. Certainly we can integrate for a rather long time, and we can beat the noise down, but in this particular instance, with the evidence that we have for proceeding on this particular project, I don't see any real point to continuing much further.
Since that search, another telescope has tuned into Sirius. It too found nothing. But Robert Temple is still confident.
The fact that a lot of people have been trying for some time now to find such a mundane answer to it, including myself, and have not succeeded, indicates that the probabilities get higher and higher that my extraordinary answer, that the Earth may actually have been visited by intelligent extraterrestrials, may really be the true answer. I personally believe that it is the true answer.
There is no easy solution. But does this mean one should automatically reach for the space gods, as von Daniken does, claiming this as final proof? Isn't it more accurate to say that in this case, we don't yet know? Given the track record of the ancient astronaut theory, which position do you choose? Von Daniken's thesis rests on inaccuracies, on distortions of the truth, on unrelated facts and false similarities. It denies man's ingenuity and abilities, and it uses phony evidence in an attempt to prove its case. Von Daniken's theories may be intriguing, even attractive, but there's not a single solid piece of evidence behind them. The achievements of the past tell us nothing about spacemen, but a great deal about the abilities and intelligence of our ancestors. And if we ever are to find other intelligent life among the stars, and that is a quest well worth pursuing, it'll be because we continue to apply that inventiveness and that questioning spirit that the ancient astronaut theory seeks so strongly to deny.